content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the March 26, 2026 online edition of the New Yorker. What happens when a whale is born? Researchers happened on the birth of a sperm whale calf, which, they found, is a complex family endeavor. By Elizabeth Colbert. On a bright blue morning in July 2023, a team of researchers took off in a catamaran from the island of Dominica in search of sperm whales. Sperm whales communicate via bursts of clicks called codas, and the researchers, part of a project called the Cetacean Translation Initiative, or CETI, CETI, are hoping one day to decipher what the codas mean. On this particular morning, they were looking to attach an electronic tag to a whale so they could record both its clicks and its movements. After a couple of hours, they happened upon 11 sperm whales bunched closely together at the surface. This behavior was odd enough that the researchers dropped their plan to tag a whale. They launched a pair of camera-equipped drones to hover above the group. After another hour or so, a great cloud of blood swirled through the water. Then, a new gray head appeared. Thanks to a crazily unlikely accident, the researchers had witnessed a sperm whale birth, and it had managed to videotape the entire event. Thanks to another crazy accident, I was on board the catamaran that day. Not only did I get to witness the birth, but also I got to watch the normally sober-minded researchers react to it. The scene on the deck resembled something out of the Marx Brothers. Everyone raced to the front of the boat to get a better view. "Oh, my God," one of the scientists said, clutching his head. "Oh, my God. Oh, my God." For the next 2 hours, the whales remained bunched together. They seemed to be nudging the baby around, but what exactly was going on was hard to say from the vantage of the catamaran. The researchers spent almost 2 years analyzing the drone footage, applying machine learning in combination with good, old-fashioned field biology. Today, they released a pair of papers chronicling what happened that July morning, one in the journal Science, the other in Scientific Reports. Their findings suggest that the whales offered the calf's mother a level of assistance that puts midwifery to shame. I think it's very enlightening to see another species working with such cooperation and care for their group, Project SETI's founder, David Gruber, who teaches biology at the City University of New York, told me. Meanwhile, we do horrible things to each other, so there's something to learn from them. Sperm whales have the largest brains of any creature on Earth. These can weigh up to 20 pounds. They are also highly social animals. Females travel together in groups that may include anywhere from a few to a few dozen members, and they share child-rearing duties. Male calves remain with their group until they are about 15 years old. After that, they lead solitary lives and approach female groups only to mate. Though sperm whales are highly mobile, they can travel tens of thousands of miles in a single year. The ones that frequent the waters off Dominica return often enough that scientists have been able to determine which whales hang out together. Individuals can be identified by the shapes of their flukes. From the drone footage, which captured the moment the baby whale's fluke first emerged, the researchers were able to determine that a whale named Rounder was the mother. Rounder is a member of a social group called Unit A, which consists of two families that are not closely related. Rounder's family includes her mother and her half-sister. The other includes an older whale named Fruit Salad, along with Fruit Salad's daughter and granddaughter. When sperm whale calves are born, weighing about a ton, they are pretty helpless. They can't immediately swim. Their flukes are bent from being cramped in the womb. And, to use the technical term, They are negatively buoyant. Left to their own devices, they will sink. What the footage showed is that for the first 3 hours of the newborn's life, the members of Unit A took turns keeping it afloat. At times, they nestled so close to the baby that they formed a sort of raft beneath it. At other points, they carried the calf draped over their enormous heads. There were several times when the newborn whale was nearly completely out of the water, the scientific report's paper notes. All the members of Unit A participated in the effort to prevent the baby from drowning, but a few, including the calf's mother and her half-sister, Aurora, took leading roles. More surprisingly, the core group also included a member of the second family, Fruit Salad's granddaughter, Ariel. For a long time, there has been this underlying hypothesis that the reason that sperm whale females live as a family is the need to communally defend and raise a calf. Shane Garrow, who is Project SETI's lead field biologist and one of the authors of both papers, told me, "But there's never really been good evidence, scientifically speaking, of something that would count as cooperation, where there's a cost involved between non-kin that are living together." I think this shows that, during birth events, non-kin cooperate in a way that is both costly and that requires some kind of logging of social behavior, like, you helped me last time, I'll help you this time. Another finding that surprised and touched the researchers was that Rounder's 15-year-old half-brother, Alan, showed up for the birth. Alan has been separating from Unit A for several years, but, like many a human teenager, he seems unsure about whether he's really ready to live on his own. Alan remained at the periphery of the group during most of the post-delivery activity, but he did eventually get close enough to touch the newborn. To me, this shows that there's a lasting bond between these animals, a social memory across time, Giro said. Earlier, members of Project SETI found that they could predict when sperm whales were likely to dive based on the sequence of codas they had exchanged. Before, during, and after the birth, the researchers were recording the interactions of Unit A via hydrophones, basically underwater microphones. They found that the whale's vocal style changed during the birth and also when a group of potentially threatening pilot whales showed up. What the sperm whales were talking about, however, remains to be decoded. It's an incredibly complex data set that is filled with all these nuances, Gruber said. But that's kind of good, because right now we are still working on the baby slope. But this kind of shows us what the double black diamond is. And now, from the April 5th, 2026 online edition of The New Yorker, how to poison an ocean. Trump envisions a new era of offshore oil drilling. Scientists know all too well how that story ends, by Jeffrey Marlowe. In September 2009, Eric Cords, a deep sea biologist, sat in a dark control room aboard the research vessel Ronald H. Brown, which was floating in the Gulf of Mexico. 1,400 meters beneath him, a remotely operated vehicle, ROV, was transmitting live video and data from the Mississippi Canyon lease area, a region just southeast of Louisiana that has long been pursued by oil companies. At first, the video feed showed little more than brown mud pockmarked by burrowing worms and snails. But a few hours into the dive, screens in the control room suddenly lit up with red, orange, yellow, and purple life forms. The ROV had stumbled upon a garden of deep water corals. It was like floating through a forest, Gords told me. It was beautiful, a different planet. An elaborate ecosystem swirled around the coral stalks, brittle stars, glass sponges, sea urchins, shrimp, fish. Cords was early in his career, looking forward to studying the dizzying biodiversity of the Gulf's hidden coral communities. 7 months later, just 11 kilometers from the coral garden, a blowout on BP's Deepwater Horizon drilling rig caused an explosion that killed 11 workers and sent oil gushing up from the seafloor. By the time the spill was finally capped, 3 months later, 780 million liters of crude had billowed into the water, the largest marine oil spill in history. Cords was horrified, but he hoped that his coral forest would be safe. Oil floats because it's lighter than water. When his team returned to the deep sea site, however, its brilliant colors were smothered under a blanket of fluffy gray scum. Mucus oozed out of the coral stems, a telltale response to trauma. The researchers realized that a mixture of oil, plankton, and a chemical dispersant used to break up slicks before they choked coastal ecosystems had rained down onto the seafloor. It was shocking, Cords told me. Everything kind of stopped. Cords' career took a dramatic turn. He would no longer study the unspoiled biodiversity of the Gulf's corals. Instead, he thought of the tainted ecosystems as ER patients. He would conduct a forensic damage assessment. This was disaster response, he told me. We needed to see who had survived. We needed to get to work. In the years since then, Cords and his team have followed nearly 300 individual coral colonies within 16 kilometers of the spill, recording minuscule changes in color, branch lengths, and physical integrity. One of the researchers on the project found that coral colonies died when they were more than half covered by the petrochemical goo. According to Cords' estimates, 25% of the corals he studied have either died or show no signs of recovery. Some were probably centuries old. Cords' cohort of scientists helped to show that the devastation of oil spills goes far beyond our coast, where birds and fish are the most visible victims. In the surface waters of the open ocean, plankton can absorb oil compounds, compromising their ability to photosynthesize and produce oxygen. When they die and sink through the water column, other marine animals eat their remains, toxins and all. Fish embryos that grow in the presence of oil may be born with heart defects, as well as spine and skull deformities. Still, he took comfort in the idea that American offshore drilling, and therefore many oil spills, might eventually be relegated to history. The Deepwater Horizon disaster sparked new regulations. Oil companies began to turn away from the areas he studied and toward deep water deposits in other places, including the Southern Caribbean and the West African coast. We were ramping down, at least in U.S. waters, Cords said. Then Donald Trump took office for the second time. And in his inaugural address, he told the nation, "We will drill, baby, drill." This past November, the U.S. Department of the Interior released plans to lease up to 1.27 billion acres of public waters for new offshore drilling efforts. Such plans don't automatically translate into new rigs. Leases have been available for years, including under the Biden administration. But regulatory costs and low oil prices had limited their appeal. The Center for Biological Diversity soon warned that if the Trump administration carried out its plans, it could cause more than 4,000 oil spills, not including large-scale disasters like Deepwater Horizon. These catastrophic incidents will become more likely as the Trump administration rolls back offshore drilling safety rules, the center said on January 6. The Trump administration went on to rescind key regulations from the National Environmental Policy Act and to exempt drilling projects in the Gulf from Endangered Species Act requirements. In the past month, since the U.S. and Israel began waging war in Iran, oil prices have spiked, which incentivizes fossil fuel companies to drill new wells. On March 9th, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management released an estimate of undiscovered oil and gas reserves in U.S. waters. 2 days later, it sold 25 leases covering 141,000 acres in the Gulf of Mexico at record low royalty rates. 2 days after that, the agency greenlit Kaskida, a new $5 billion ultra-deep drilling project southwest of New Orleans, which could start pumping 80,000 barrels of oil a day as early as 2029. The Gulf is open for business again, and Cords is bracing himself. The more drilling we do, the more oil we're going to release into the environment, he said. It's really that simple. In the past 50 years, he said, North American waters have seen three catastrophic spills. Ixtaczoka 1 in 1979, Exxon Valdez in 1989, and Deepwater Horizon in 2010. It's been 15 years since we've had one, Cord said. You can do the math. We're just about due for another. The first offshore oil wells were drilled in California, where black tar has been oozing out of the ground for eons. In what is now the La Brea tar pits, sticky pools of asphalt famously trapped dire wolves and saber-toothed cats. More recently, indigenous people such as the Chumash and the Yokuts used asphalt to make face paint, game pieces, glue, and waterproofing caulk for boats and baskets. When the British captain George Vancouver sailed through the Santa Barbara Channel in 1792, he noted that the surface of the sea, which was perfectly smooth and tranquil, was covered with a thick, slimy substance. The era of oil drilling began not long after James Young, a Scottish chemist, collected a sample of petroleum near an English coal mine in the mid-19th century. He heated the liquid in a flask and collected the condensate, which burned cleaner and was cheaper than whale oil, the standard fuel of the day. Summerlin Beach is a mile-long crest of sand just down the coast from Santa Barbara. The Santa Ynez Mountains rise directly to the north, pinning Highway 1 tightly to the coast. On most days, the surf is loud enough to mask the steady purr of cars. In the 1890s, oil drillers tapped into pools beneath the sand. New wells crept all the way to the surf's edge and eventually into the water. Droves of workmen were hired to build sturdy piers. By 1896, the offshore rigs were operational. Their pipes extended down through several meters of water and a couple of hundred more of seafloor sediment. A bust inevitably followed. In 1903, a vicious winter storm reduced most of the piers to splinters, and by 1906, offshore oil production at Summerlin had all but ceased. Still, a threshold had been crossed. Offshore wells proliferated. Steel piers replaced wooden structures, and rigs reached farther from shore. Along the Gulf of Mexico coast, drilling ships allowed for mobile overwater operations. Floating platforms moved into deeper waters. Between 1954 and 1971, offshore oil production in the United States expanded more than tenfold. Off the coast of Summerlin, standalone platforms named Hazel, Hilda, and Heidi were erected in California's waters, which extended 5.5 kilometers from shore. Beyond that, in federal waters, were Hogan, Hu Chin, and Platform A. On January 28, 1969, a drill extending 1,100 meters into the seafloor beneath Platform A punched through a layer of rock and into a pocket of oil. When the crew retracted the drill to replace its bit, an overpowering jet of oil fountained from the well. They managed to plug the pipe, but growing subterranean pressure created cracks in the seafloor. Oil rushed through the sediment and rock and blackened the water. 11 million liters of oil spread across an area of 2,000 square kilometers. Even after the leaks were plugged with cement, rivulets of oil persisted for months, and the oil spill's ecological and cultural impact lasted even longer. Dead seals and dolphins washed ashore. Fishermen found lobsters and crabs painted black and weighed down by oil. It was the birds, though, that seized the public's attention and launched a movement. From Ventura to Santa Barbara, gulls, pelicans, murres, and grebes staggered along beaches, unable to fly. Locals mobilized to save them. A nearby zoo recommended feeding the birds butter to emulsify and flush out the oil in their throats. According to a Los Angeles Times report, birds fleeing their would-be rescuers instinctively waddled toward the water, and, falling into the black liquid, they lay in the ooze, crying weakly. Cormorants that tried to clean each other with their beaks died after ingesting the viscous muck. Others expired from hypothermia. The oil compromised their feathers' water-repelling properties. Catherine Morse, a professor of history and environmental studies at Middlebury College, has written that images of these birds mark a turning point in society's relationship with the oil industry. They contested older visual narratives of oil as abundant and powerful. Around the same time, the Washington Post decried the systematic fouling of our nest, and the New York Times called the pursuit of petroleum a survival issue both for sea life and for man himself. The political fallout was lasting. President Richard Nixon walked on the beach and flew over the slick in a helicopter. He vowed to take more effective control over the oil industry and opined that preserving beaches is more important than economic considerations. The oil spill helped inspire the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Clean Water Act, and the Endangered Species Act. California declared a moratorium on offshore drilling projects. In a blow to the fledgling environmental movement, however, a report by Nixon's science advisor, Lee DuBridge, called for more drilling, not less. The situation which makes leaks possible, DuBridge wrote, is the fact that there is oil down there. The only way to prevent future leaks is to get that oil out. In the summer of 1969, less than 6 months after the spill, several additional wells were drilled from Platform A. An entirely new rig was towed from an Oakland shipyard and installed just to the east of the platform. The offshore oil industry had weathered the environmental reckoning and emerged intact, and arguably stronger. More spills polluted California's beaches. In 1990, a tanker ship ran over its own anchor. A quarter century later, a pipeline on land ruptured, sending a river of oil straight to the sea. In 2010, when I was at graduate school in California, I took a barefoot walk on Summerlin Beach at dusk. It was only the next morning, when my soles stuck to the floorboards of my apartment, that I noticed quarter-sized globs of tar stuck to my feet like wads of black gum. I couldn't find any news online about a local oil spill. Instead, I discovered that such tar balls are so common that they've inspired a product called Oil Slick, a beach tar remover spray. Oil had permanently altered California's coast. And yet, when viewed through the lens of today's oil industry, the drilling efforts in the Santa Barbara Channel may seem quaint. In the Gulf of Mexico, an even more profound transformation has taken place. The Gulf of Mexico formed about 200 million years ago when the supercontinent Pangaea split up. During periods of high sea levels, salt water flooded into the basin between North and South America and formed a shallow sea where algae thrived. When the water periodically evaporated, it left thick deposits of salt. Then rivers carried eroded particles from the Rockies, the Appalachians, and other mountain ranges that have come and gone into the basin, covering the salt and decaying algae beneath kilometers of sediment. The weight of the sediment had the effect of a slow-motion pressure cooker. Biological molecules were deconstructed and flattened into a tangled mess of mostly carbon and hydrogen. This goo is called kerogen, and geologists estimate that it contains about 10,000 times as much carbon as all the biomass on Earth today. Kerogen is more a category than a specific thing, like jazz or casseroles. Each molecule can contain more than 200 carbon atoms twisted into a dizzying array of rings and folds. At the greatest depths, where temperatures and pressures are highest, the kerogen tends to split into smaller hydrocarbons, such as methane, the main component in natural gas. At more moderate pressures and temperatures, oil forms. What makes the Gulf of Mexico such a bonanza of fossil fuel production isn't just the sheer quantity of algae that was cooked to the right specifications, but also the layers that it's encased in. Oil and gas infuse the pores of sandstone. Layers of impermeable caprock trap it inside. In 2014, 4 years after the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe, I boarded the research vessel Atlantis in New Orleans for an expedition into the Gulf. I was early in my career as a microbiologist, and I was hoping to study places where methane naturally seeps from the seafloor, supporting remarkable ecosystems of deep-sea life. At dawn, we began to wind through the misty coils of the Mississippi Delta, passing pelicans that sat on mossy wooden docks. As we entered the Gulf, we suddenly came upon an unseemly jumble of cranes and metal scaffolding, a vast oil rig. More were soon visible all around us, ringing the horizon. It's nearly impossible to definitively determine the number of offshore oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. They are constantly built and removed as the oil market ebbs and flows. NOAA estimates that about 6,000 structures have been built over the water since 1942, and many of them remain viable. Some are not much more apparent than a telephone pole. The rigs we saw from Atlantis were more akin to floating cities. There are likely a couple hundred such platforms currently operating in state and federal waters off the coasts of Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. Our destination was the Mississippi Canyon, an incision now underwater that formed roughly 30,000 years ago when the Mississippi flowed more than 100 kilometers past its modern-day delta. My goal was to inspect calcium carbonate rocks found near methane seeps at the base of the canyon walls in search of methane-eating microbes. I imagined that they might be unsung heroes of carbon sequestration in the deep sea, turning methane, a potent greenhouse gas, into rock. One morning, a few of my colleagues crawled into the ship's submersible, Alvin, and descended to the seafloor, where they found microbial mats growing on mounds of craggy gray rock. At one site, in a trough, they found frozen methane hydrate, bone-white ice, and a thin stream of bubbles. Using Alvin's robotic arm, they plucked a few rocks from the seafloor. Later, in the ship's main lab, I placed those rocks in sterile plastic bins and readied my tools. My plan was to chisel off fist-sized fragments in search of microbes. Before I could lift my hammer, however, I noticed pinpricks of black liquid covering the rocks. The dots soon became acrid splotches of oil. At first, I mistook the splotches as remnants of the Deepwater Horizon spill. But then I realized, with a start, that I was seeing a natural process. The rocks, recently depressurized after their journey from the seafloor, were oozing petroleum. In the end, I found the hydrocarbon-eating microbes that I was looking for. They are a type of archaea that perish in the presence of oxygen, and they form intricate relationships with bacteria that breathe sulfur compounds. My colleagues, meanwhile, use forceps to pick glistening scale worms and peanut worms from the rocks. The life amid the oil was a stark reminder that, for all of petroleum's destructive power, it's still a natural substance, capable of fueling ecosystems as well as cars. It's as much a product of nature as orchids or tree trunks. In some parts of the Gulf, hydrocarbons gush directly out of the seafloor. Mud volcanoes ooze liquefied brown sediment and emit shimmering curtains of methane bubbles. Oil stalagmites emerge from the seafloor, pulled upward by their buoyancy. Asphalt ribbons form tar lilies that resemble toothpaste squeezed from a tube. Considering the quantity of hydrocarbons that are naturally entering Gulf of Mexico waters, what exactly constitutes an environmental disaster? If some oil sloshes off a ship or leaks out of a pipeline, what's the difference? Mandy Joy, an oceanographer specializing in microbiology at the University of Georgia, has spent decades characterizing microbes in hydrocarbon-rich habitats across the Gulf. Her discoveries have underscored a key biological principle. Virtually every flavor of hydrocarbon can be eaten by something. However, the microbes that digest them are often found at low abundances. They are members of the rare biosphere, and under typical conditions, they can take months to replicate. 10 times the normal rate of hydrocarbon seepage, Joy told me, is probably the cutoff between a natural process these ecosystems can handle and an anthropogenic disaster that they maybe can't. Above that threshold, the microbes can't keep up. The other problem is when the oil goes places it shouldn't. The oil industry amounts to a vast program of oil relocation and transformation. It sucks crude from subsurface rocks into metal pipes, tanks, and refinery reservoirs, spitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere all the while. When this relocation process breaks down, a viscous black liquid flows into marine environments. Plants and animals are evolutionarily unprepared. The Center for Biological Diversity estimated that the Deepwater Horizon disaster harmed or killed more than 80,000 birds, 6,000 sea turtles, and 25,000 dolphins and whales. Oil coated 2,100 kilometers of shoreline. It suffocated salt marsh grasses and oysters and, by weakening root systems, accelerated erosion. One study valued the environmental damage at $17.2 billion. These assessments focused on surface waters and coastlines, the part of the Gulf we interact with most frequently. Yet, much of the oil never made it to shore. It fell into the deep sea. What exactly happened down there? There's a theory in the study of microbial ecology attributed to the Dutch polymath Laurent Bekking that everything is everywhere, but the environment selects. The first part, everything is everywhere, argues that the swirl of wind and water transports organisms to every habitable nook and cranny on Earth. The second, the environment selects, suggests that environmental conditions produce microbial winners and losers. A photosynthetic algae may sink to the seafloor, but it's not going to survive in complete darkness. The hypothesis is imperfect, but one could see its principles at work in the aftermath of Deepwater Horizon. Scientists have understood since 1913 that certain microbes are capable of degrading oil. Many of them make up a tiny minority of the microbes in a given ecosystem, but they were present in the Gulf. In May 2010, Joy was the first microbiologist on the scene of the oil spill. She was part of a monitoring effort that sent a water sampling device within 100 meters of the discharge zone. When they pulled water samples on board, the bitter scent of hexane, a component of petroleum, permeated the respirator that Joy was wearing. "Those samples were the nastiest thing I've ever seen," she told me. She watched with disgust as a colleague's protective gloves disintegrated around his fingers. Over the years, she and her fellow scientists sampled the water dozens of times. They assembled a detailed account of the microbial population during different phases of the oil's degradation. About half of the oil from Deepwater Horizon accumulated in a soupy plume that hovered at a depth of around 1,100 meters. Within about a month, a lineage of Oceanospiralis microbes proliferated, feasting on cyclohexane. Microbial populations inside the oil plume were about 2 orders of magnitude higher than in the uncontaminated water, and 99% of them had oil-degrading properties. A few weeks later, Cycloclasticus stormed into the scene. Fueled by a range of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon molecules, then came Coelia, feeding off short chains of oil-derived hydrocarbons such as ethane and propane. Once the well was capped, the community shifted again. Microbes from the Flavobacteriaceae and Rhodobacteriaceae families mopped up longer-chain hydrocarbons. In the water above the blowout, Bob Becking's aphorism proved true. The key players were lurking the whole time. As the plume's chemical profile changed, different types of microbes bloomed and then receded in a sort of ecological relay race. Joy estimates that 30 to 40% of the oil was degraded by microbial communities, a feat for which we can only be grateful. Even so, tens of millions of liters of oil swirled through the Gulf. Much of it was lofted by tiny gas pockets into the upper water column, only to fall back downward after the bubbles fizzed into the atmosphere. The effect of the sinking oil, Joy told me, was like dropping flypaper through the water column. All of the biology was just getting stripped out and moved to the seafloor, as were the nutrients associated with those organisms. In some places, fish catches declined precipitously in medium depths, which Joy attributes to nutritionally barren conditions. The effect on deep-sea organisms was even more dire. 5 centimeters of flocculent oil fluff blanketed the seafloor, the equivalent of thousands of years of sediment dumped in just a few months. It was completely absurd, Joy said. For crabs, worms, and other invertebrates, there was nowhere to run and hide. Cords, the coral researchers, said that some of the oil-coated corals recovered, but most didn't. They lost branches, and their withering skeletons were colonized by hydroids. Deep-sea corals operate on different timescales than their shallow water relatives. They can live for thousands of years. As the oil settled, centuries of growth were undone. These ancient ecosystems are easy to remove, Cords told me, but impossible to replace. Conservationists have become creative in an effort to rescue damaged habitats. The area around an oil spill can be seeded with probiotics of naturally occurring hydrocarbon-eating microbes, which help shallow water corals fight oil damage 3 times faster than corals left to their own devices. Artificial corals can give deep water marine life a place to live. Cat sharks, for example, wrap necklace-like egg cases around any structure, natural or not, that sticks up from the seafloor. Even the infrastructure of the oil industry can become a habitat. A rigs-to-reef strategy converts derelict wells into scaffolds for new reefs, empty apartment buildings, essentially, welcoming new denizens to move in. In the Gulf, more than 600 offshore oil and gas platforms have been reefed since the 80s, and many are now oases for fish such as amberjack, filefish, spadefish, and red snapper. They're also often overrun by invasive orange cup corals and lionfish, which crowd out native fauna. The deep sea may wind up full of these prosthetic habitats, ecosystems that function in some ways, but that remain diminished and hollow compared to their natural state. Even after studying deep water corals for 3 decades, Cords continues to make new discoveries. By 2024, his team had mapped nearly all of an enormous reef off the Carolina coast, perched 1,000 meters down. It was this incredibly diverse, beautiful coral reef, he told me. There were some species he'd never seen before. He often wonders how many hidden coral ecosystems could be destroyed and how many were lost before we even knew they existed. One of his most painful findings emerged among the gray, oil-coated corals near the deep water horizon blowout site. Purple-pink brittle stars still clung to the corals, their tendril-like arms wrapping around the branches like yarn. In late 2010, Cords and his team noticed that some parts of the corals had cleared up. The brittle stars were removing the oil, revealing vibrant yellow tissue beneath. It was the first direct evidence of a mutualistic relationship between the two species. The brittle stars got an elevated perch from which to feed. The corals got a cleaning. Deep-sea scientists rarely have a chance to return to the same places, but Cords continued to revisit his Gulf corals. Nearly a year later, he was in the control room of the Ronald H. Brown watching live video from a decimated coral garden known as MC-294. He leaned forward as the ROV approached an intricate coral colony that he'd come to know well. When he spotted its distinctive dendritic branches, its off-kilter lean, and its patches of healthy yellow tissue, he was heartened. The coral was on the road to recovery. But something was missing. Brittle stars. After cleaning so much oily residue off the corals, Korge concluded they had died. It was tragic, he told me. It felt like, in order to see these fundamental truths, something awful had to happen. And now, from the March 23, 2026 issue of The New Yorker, can psychoanalysis help you get the life you want? In a new book, Adam Phillips wages a playful war on the strictures of traditional talk therapy by Katie Waldman. In Monogamy, a collection of 121 aphorisms on coupling and uncoupling, the psychoanalyst and prolific writer Adam Phillips suggests that the faithful and the promiscuous aren't so different. Both are idealists, he writes, deranged by hope, in awe of reassurance, impressed by their pleasures. The book criticizes monogamy as a way of getting the versions of ourselves down to a minimum. But it doesn't exactly defend infidelity. Phillips' real target may be monotony, the offspring of rote rule following. We take monogamy for granted, he writes, and treat it as the norm, sleepwalking into a future without considering whether it actually satisfies us. Ironically, Phillips' strongest defense of sexual exclusivity is that a steadfast union might offer the same turnabouts and dramas, the same incandescences and crashing disappointments that you'd normally pursue via cheating. Perhaps we value monogamy because it lets us have it both ways, he writes. Novelty and continuity, enchantment and disillusion, the lives we live and those we merely visit in our dreams. What do we want from the lives that we secretly imagine for ourselves? A difficult mixture of the all-too-familiar and the experimental, the mostly reassuring and the partly disinhibited. Adam Phillips contends in his latest book, The Life You Want. When we were children, he continues, our parents recognized some parts of us and not others. Athleticism, but not musicality, for instance, or cheerfulness, but not guile. Now we go around both upholding and rebelling against those received regimes. We alternately display and downplay our encouraged aspects, hide and flaunt our uncountenanced ones. Haunted by the versions of ourselves that remain unembodied, Phillips writes, we wish to be who we are and also who we aren't, splitting the difference even in fantasy. Admin and bad romance novelists would like us to think that wanting is straightforward, indivisible, intuitive, and perhaps best remedied by credit card. For Phillips, however, wanting isn't so simple. It has byways and switchbacks, weight and depth. What if we want something forbidden? What if the objects of our longing are socially acceptable but undermine who we'd like to be? What if we try to attain our aims and fail? What if we succeed and are disappointed, or the intensity of our delectation causes us to lose ourselves? And then, Phillips warns, there is the scandalous origin of our wanting, our helplessness, our abjection, and our dependence. We cannot satisfy ourselves. We must make demands on others. Worse, others make demands on us. Interacting with one's peers is never exactly what one was hoping for. Phillips observes Riley in Missing Out, a book from 2012, in praise of the unlived life. Socializing involves no fewer than three consecutive frustrations. The frustration of need, the frustration of the fantasized satisfaction not working, and the frustration of satisfaction in the real world being at odds with the wish for fantasized satisfaction. And that, he adds, is when everything goes well. Yet, it is only in states of frustration that we can begin to imagine, to elaborate, to envision our desire, Phillips writes. He's articulating the traditional Freudian account of fantasy guiding us toward our best-case scenario, the ordinary unhappiness of reality, or what Phillips calls the possibility of a more realistic satisfaction. But one also feels his work pulling in a less orthodox direction, toward the pleasure of longing itself. For Freud, wishful thinking was an abandonment of reality. For Phillips, it's an information source, one we jettison too quickly in our quest to be cured. The life you want finds Philip chafing at his field's prescriptiveness and dismayed by our inclination to submit to other people's preemptive conclusions about what we want. Old-fashioned psychoanalysis always had a known destination, he observes. There's a risk that the patient gets up from the couch, having discovered not her druthers, but what Melanie Klein or Jacques Lacan or Sigmund Freud thought her druthers should be. Describing the life we want, Phillips cautions, can sometimes be the most compliant, i.e. defensive, thing we ever do. Phillips is a figure for our therapy-soaked era, even if, for him, therapy feeds into and enables life, whereas we often seem to view life as feeding into and enabling therapy. He spent decades translating specialized concepts for general audiences, demystifying transference and projection, peeking under the hood of everyday occupations such as tickling and being bored, drawing on classic works of literature to illustrate the relevance of his field to ordinary experience. A shaman of the psychoanalytic slate pitch, he often adopts an impish persona, issuing counterintuitive pronouncements about the benefits of quitting, pessimism, or shame. He once told the Paris Review that his adolescent study of English literature prepared him to ironize the ambitions of grand theory. Elsewhere, he has remarked with an unmistakable air of indulgence on how much of human endeavor, from art and prayer to political activity, is explicable as a form of attention seeking. In his published writing, which extends to more than 20 books, Phillips shows a love of mischief and tomfoolery. His wordplay is sporadically self-delighted. His pose of guileless receptivity caused Joan Acosella to compare him in this magazine to a child wondering what would happen if he pushed a pencil up his nose. He believes that we are incorrigibly self-defeating, that we constantly obstruct our own knowledge because we fear being in a position to sate our wayward desires. Hence, perhaps a contrarianism, a commitment to reversing whatever expectation the reader might be imagined to hold in an attempt to disarm and deprogram, possibly even cure her. Phillips is a Freudian, but a selective and partial one, preferring to emphasize his predecessor's sensitive, more literary aspects. The Austrian doctor was interested in sentences and the fact that language is evocative as well as informative, Phillips told an interviewer after he was tapped to edit a volume of the Penguin Modern Classics edition of Freud. In Becoming Freud, a slender circumlocutory biography, Phillips conjures a champion for patients, someone who, like a good parent or a good art critic, could appreciate what they were up to. He can be flippant about psychoanalysis. In one essay describing the analyst's interpretation of the analysand as a sophisticated form of interruption, undertaken to make the analyst feel important. In Irreverence, an essay from the new book, he depicts the titular concept as a way of testing authority, whether your target can withstand such shot-taking, and also a love test, whether your target will want to remain on reasonably good terms with you. If the irreverent are wholly dependent on those they mock, he writes, irreverence is also potentially a sign of growing up. By that standard, the most recent work, animated by the question of what therapy should be and how it might help you get the life you want, is pretty mature. With no summing insouciance, Phillips recruits the pragmatic philosopher Richard Rorty, or an imagined version of him, to vocalize his discontent with the strictures of his discipline. Rorty used the phrase God terms for ideas, such as human nature or objective reality, that alienate us from our agency by appealing to a higher truth. Phillips, a Londoner, takes him as a stand-in for American optimism about the power of positive thinking. The life you want sets out to shape Freud into a more amenable ancestor, someone better suited to Phillips' purposes. It's what Rorty would call a creative redescription of the goals of psychoanalysis, redescription being the quintessential pragmatic activity, a flexible trying out of different stories or perspectives until you find one that works for you. As Phillips freely admits, his redescription, and perhaps redescription in general, might be naively wishful, not a bending of reality, but a flight from it. Freud's biggest contribution to psychoanalytic thought might be his portrait of persecutory, enigmatic, and disturbing unconscious. For Rorty, the Freudian id is another God term, a bad faith bid to delegate and outsource our purposes and our imagination and our intelligence to something beyond ourselves, as Phillips puts it. Rorty, he writes, prefers to envision the unconscious as a team of partners or interlocutors, all of them really useful, helpful, and informed. The prospect delights Phillips, but he's skeptical. Does pragmatism's redescription merely baffle our efforts to understand and transform our darker impulses? It's when we refuse to face what we really want, he worries, that we grow pliant and manipulable, vulnerable to the lure of instant gratification and denied the chance to make something tonic out of our frustration. Freud theorized that our lives are a project of tempering and downgrading desire, an ongoing compromise between fantasy and reality. By contrast, Phillips writes that the Rortian seeks the most inclusive conversation possible with our unconscious selves, one that will further and proliferate our purposes and increase our sense of autonomy. Strikingly, we should try to proliferate our purposes, not just advance them. If the father of talk therapy aimed to mitigate our wanting's intensity, Rorty sought to intervene in its monomania. Phillips lays this out in Too Bad or On Seeing the Worst, a chapter about an essay by the Romanian author Emil Cioran, speculating that our elemental self, our daemon, might never have wanted to have been born in the first place. A Freudian might ask lugubriously how we might endure such pain. Phillips seizes the opportunity to wonder what we might gain from expressing a permanently unattainable desire. Having been born, he writes, is the one problem we can never solve. Perhaps, he offers, a loosening is possible, some breathing room, some permission to look around at what else might appeal. Via Rorty, he invites us to consider that we can desire many things and to live in a way that tests this hypothesis, releasing ourselves from the stranglehold of our single-minded obsessions. We have ourselves put the authorities deep down inside us, Phillips writes in The Life You Want. In Against Self-Criticism, a 2015 essay for the London Review of Books, he picks a fight with the Freudian superego, whose ceaseless opprobrium, he claims, objectifies the rest of the psyche, reducing it to a single blameworthy victim. In fact, he writes, there is more to our inner ensemble than convict and executioner or prisoner and despot. Each of us contains a repressed repertoire of fragmentary alternative selves. Where judgment is, there conversation should be. Where there is dogma, there is an uncompleted experiment. Instead of letting your superego browbeat the other dramatis personae into submission, you should emulate a podcast host moderating a respectful discussion among your mental parts. His ideal of the psyche, in which all self-fragments get a hearing, can be extrapolated onto a society whose members are free to debate one another as they decide their paths forward. In his book, Equals, he writes that being listened to can enable one to bear and even to enjoy listening to oneself and others, which democracy itself depends on. Psychoanalysis is misnamed as a talking cure, he submits. Really, it is a listening cure. Unsurprisingly, one of the political forms he's most interested in is the relationship between analyst and analysand. Phillips writes that self-criticism is our most unpleasant and our most sadomasochistic way of loving ourselves, an attempt to win over the authorities when we fear we can't otherwise live up to their expectations. In his telling, the patient often wants to comply with the heroic, omniscient analyst in order to avoid thinking for herself. The analyst must guard against this dynamic and against his own desire to dominate the patient. For Phillips, analysis is meant to help us with our idealizations, with our craving for authority, our wish to idolize and be controlled. The threat is that the analyst instead comes to resemble the superego, a boring and vicious soliloquist with an audience of one. What do we need psychoanalysis for, then? For Phillips, the answer comes back to the intricate turnings and archaeological layers of desire. Rorty believes that we are good at knowing what we want. Phillips writes, a contention that erases our ambivalence and underestimates our need for safety. Moreover, he claims the Rortorian vision of desire is informed by a shallow and too innocent view of the unconscious. Insensible to our Stygian instincts, pragmatism is always threatening to shade into permissiveness, a kind of capricious, impulsive egotism. It's true that, without Rorty, Freud can appear omniscient and impoverishing. But without Freud, Phillips suggests, Rorty can't surface the sunken richness of our wanting, its destructiveness, its haunting strangeness. Pragmatism fails to listen to desire. As a result, an essential texture of life escapes its grasp. Like monogamy and infidelity, or our lived and unlived lives, psychoanalysis and pragmatism need each other. The plenitude, variety, and pluralism that are the highest values of liberal democracy require the force and insight of the psychoanalytic tradition, and vice versa. It's unclear, though, that any of these pairs can be fully reconciled. The best case, Phillips implies, might be a conversation, not the idealized sort that results in unanimity or even acceptance, but a realistic one that grants the participants their full difficulty and irrationality and acknowledges that alignment might remain out of reach. Still, the fantasy of a more perfect union persists. In one chapter of The Life You Want, Phillips describes the Freudian dream work. During the day, he explains, we unconsciously pick things out that will be used in the making of our night's dream. This idea that our unconscious gathers material during the day to dream with at night suggests that what Rorty wants for us, to proliferate our purposes, to look around at what else we might want, is, in Phillips' reading of Freud, already ours. By subjecting our inner worlds to such devoted scrutiny, the author of The Interpretation of Dreams emphasizes, in Phillips' words, the sheer scale of our interest. The possible lives we formulate, even when we don't realize we're doing so. The life you want is itself a sort of dream work, which synthesizes opposing elements into a poetic, if wishful, whole. We've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website, again, is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.